Hej och varmt välkommen till Börssnack med Hansén och Olavi. Och det är jag som är Erik Hansén och jobbar som marknadsstrateg på Neuroquant.
Och jag heter Jonas Olavi, är allokeringschef och fondförvaltare på Alpcot.
Jag har haft en bra vecka, Jonas.
Det har varit blandad börsmässigt, men det är bara att kavla upp ärmarna och kämpa på.
Mm. Och Börssnack är en podd från tradingmäklaren IG. Så stort tack till IG som står bakom Börssnack. Hos IG kan man handla ett stort utbud av marknader och det är bra öppettider. Så gärna in på ig.com för att läsa mer där. Man kan också prenumerera på IGs YouTube-kanal. Det bland annat jag lägger upp lite market updates varje börsdag, varje morgon.
Kolla, det gör
på, kolla på dem.
Ja, då, absolut. Såklart.
Ja, så att gå gärna in på ig.com. Glöm inte att all handel innebär såklart risk. Så att läs på ordentligt innan man börjar handla. Ja, det är mycket som händer. Vad har vi på dagens agenda? Vad fokuserar vi på?
Ja, vi kommer att prata om det som har hänt. Det är en ganska galen börs just nu. Mm. Du har lite tankar på när man kan hitta en botten. Vad är det för signaler du letar efter? Jag kommer beskriva lite grann vad jag har försökt göra med aktieportföljen då, fonden Alcott Equities. Försökt dra ner risken, beskriva lite grann hur och vilka effekter det har fått. Men vi har med oss en riktigt bra gäst idag och det är Lombard's Head of Strategy, Andrea Ciccione. Very welcome to our podcast, Andrea. Very nice to have you here.
Thanks for having me.
I think we're going to start with five quick questions.
Okay, sounds like a plan.
All right. So will the global stock markets stand higher or lower at the year's end?
Oh, a year from now. Well, probably lower, I would say. At least in the near term, definitely lower.
Okay.
If you would have to choose one market from a relative perspective and you have four to choose from, would you invest in US, Europe, Japan or EM?
Definitely the US.
Okay, and that maybe was the answer on this question, value or growth for the rest of 2022?
I am not a big fan of value. I think value is a misnomer. Value is just slow growth. So in an environment like this one, when stock market is falling, definitely value, it's more defensive. But the moment the market bottoms out, absolutely growth.
Yeah.
Soft landing, recession or stagflation?
Probably not stagflation. Mm. We think we're still going to have a counter-cyclical inflation problem, as we do now. Recession, quite possibly, in the euro area, in China, maybe in the US next year. That's our forecast at the moment.
Mm.
China, the savior of global growth.
Not this time. This time is dragging down growth. They're experiencing a cyclical slowdown caused by their property sector problems. So it's not going to save the world this time.
Okay.
Då kör vi.
Börssnack med Hansén och Olavi.
Ja, innan vi tar samtalet med Andrea så kör vi en liten kort sedvanlig market update. Mm. Det är fortsatt hög volatilitet på aktiemarknaden. Bostadspriserna börjar falla nu. Det är hög inflation. Vi har krig i Europa. Det är avtagande tillväxt och centralbankerna börjat strama åt de finansiella förhållanden. I veckan så såg vi att detaljhandelskedjorna Walmart och Target föll kraftigt. Det var den största två dagars nedgången sedan 1987. Så att det är betydligt mycket kraftigare kostnadsökningar i många bolagen, kanske vad folk hade förväntat sig. Så att 2022, vart år, där vi måste försöka skydda kapitalet. Defensiva marknader har ju gått starkare såklart. Lågvolatila aktier, energi, consumer staples, som är lite mer defensiva bolagen. Men som long only förvaltare, då är det svårt att ta skydd. Hur agerar man? Hur gör man?
Ja, man måste ju ändå tro på bolagen man investerar i. Man måste vara i kontakt med dem, försöka förstå vilka trender som gäller. Värderingarna blir lite egentligen obsolet att fundera kring, utan det är ju vinsterna, vinststabiliteten och hur balansräkningar ser ut då. Och jag har ju försökt mitigera en portfölj som var ganska mycket högre beta-aktier när året slutade till att ha betydligt lägre beta nu. Jag har kommit ner på 1,02 i beta. Och det har jag gjort då genom att inkludera bolag som har lägre volatilitet till exempel, men som har stabil intjäning. Med den typen av bolag letar jag efter, och jag blev lite förvånad faktiskt för de enorma reaktionerna som det blev på Walmart och Target. För att det här är ju bolag som ändå upplevs som så här hyggligt trygga, man handlar ju mat så att säga. Och man kunde inte se att det var vinsterna, eller försäljningen förlåt, som det var fel på, utan det var ju vinsterna på grund av att kostnaderna kommit upp och de har inte lyckats trycka det vidare då. Det kanske på något vis är ett lite positivt tecken att det stoppar där. För mycket av tillverkningsindustrin har ju haft jättelätt att föra kostnaderna vidare, därför att de har inte konsument som närmsta kund, utan de har ett annat bolag som kund. Och så fortsätter man tills man når konsumenterna då. Men Walmart och Target, de har ju slutkonsumenter.
Du menar att bolagen tar smällen, skickar inte vidare till konsumenterna, och det kommer hålla tillväxten i relativt hög takt?
Ja, så länge som konsumenten accepterar det. Men till slut så gör man inte det. Då börjar man köpa mindre grejer kanske, eller färre saker. Man köper billigare saker. Det är den normala trenden. Och det brukar ju ofta vara så också att sparandet går upp under sådana här perioder när man är osäker. Nu är ju arbetsmarknaden stark, men om det fortsätter så här så att bolagen till slut måste börja fundera på hur man ska optimera antalet anställda. Så till exempel Sandvik ut med sparpaket och 500 personer eller någonting sånt där som kommer att få lämna bolaget, som ju i sig går väldigt bra då. Mm. Men när man ändå tittar på den här typen av tendenser, det blir folk oroliga för. Konsumenterna, de som jobbar i bolagen, börjar fundera. Och då kan det gå ganska fort med de här inbromsningsfaktorerna. Och en anekdot är, jag har pratat med en rådgivare bland annat då till Hjälpkott-nätverket som har mycket känningar inom bygg. Där pratar man om en ganska snabb inbromsning här efter sommaren. Mm. Och där ser man ju fler och fler sådana tecken. Man slutar bygga, och framförallt då kanske man inte bygger den här verandan eller poolen eller vad det nu är för någonting. Då går det fort neråt då i efterfrågan.
Ja, men det såg vi till exempel nu i veckan. Det kom in NAHB, Home Builder Index, från USA, visar sentimentet på bland husbyggarna i USA. Det var länge sedan det indexet toppade, och det brukar vara ledande för den ekonomiska cykeln, och det fortsätter att falla. Mm. Just humöret bland husbyggare. Det är högre kostnader, det är högre bolåneräntor, det är lägre efterfrågan som de ser där. Och vi fick in lite statistik här också från ValueGuard i veckan på svenska bostadspriser. Mm. Och där ser vi att bostadspriserna föll tillbaka här i april, men att nedgången har varit betydligt mycket högre också i början av maj, som de också mäter. Men de siffrorna får vi in nästa månad. Så folk är betydligt mycket mer defensiva och är lite mer oroliga såklart för sin privata ekonomi. Och det är inte så konstigt. Men som privat investerare så har man betydligt mycket högre flexibilitet än som en långhållig förvaltare. Jag kan ju dra ner min bruttoexponering i portföljen genom att sälja och ha hög kassa. Jag kan dra ner nettoexponeringen genom att blanka aktier och kort och så vidare. Mm. Jag kan stå utanför marknaden helt och hållet om jag vill. Mm. Så att som privatsparare eller som privatinvesterare så ska man ju tänka på att det finns fördelar.
Ja, definitivt.
Och passa på också och använda de fördelar man har. Står man utanför marknaden så kommer man inte förlora några pengar. Det är bara inflationen som äter upp pengarna till slut. Mm. Men ja.
Men lite vad Jonas Dahlqvist till exempel sa i en föregående podd, så kan man ju vara med och liksom satsa lite av kapitalet när man tycker att man har bra läge, man har mycket kassa. Ja, det är ju ett sätt att jobba. Inte hela tiden vara jättehårt exponerad, och cykler kommer och går, och det är klart att vi kommer komma ur det här också. Mm. Förhoppningsvis snabbare än långsamt, men vi vet ju å andra sidan inte hur länge det här pågår. Så att.
Nej. Men jag kan ju dra några exempel på vad jag kollar på för att just få få tecken eller signal om en liksom större viktig botten, en så kallad cykelbotten i marknaden. Rent fundamentalt för den ekonomiska cykeln, då kollar jag på riktningen på tillväxtdata. Flera olika så här högfrekventa tillväxtdata, allt från PMI, data och så vidare. Just riktningen, den riktningen är fortsatt neråt. Jag vill gärna se att den vänder uppåt, eller i alla fall se tecken från att marknaden börjar prisa in att den datan ska vända uppåt. Ofta brukar då marknadscykeln ligga lite före den ekonomiska cykeln. Då kan man ju se tecken från marknaden, till exempel index som Russell 2000 och de här lite mer högbeta, ofta lite mer ledande än till exempel S&P 500 eller OMXS30. Så vi ser tecken på att marknaden börjar prisa in att tillväxtdata kommer att vända då. Man kan också kolla på olika spreadar, till exempel mot spread mellan junk bonds och investment grade. Den fortsätter att stiga. Jag vill gärna se att den vänder ner. För ofta så har den vänt ner då, när vi sett större bottnar på aktiemarknaden.
Därför att högre riskaptit helt enkelt. Då ja. Jagar man de här högre riskfyllare namnen och då går spelarna ihop igen. Då.
Precis. Junk bonds, det är så kallade skräpobligationer som är lite mer riskfyllare. Och sen rent tekniskt, om man kollar i graferna, så är det antingen att man kan få en så kallad V-botten. Säger tjoff på nedsidan, sen upp igen. Och då brukar man ofta säga hög volym, ofta en väldigt hög nivå på VIX-index, många som har köpt säljoptioner och så vidare, många som har tagit skydd. Så får vi ofta en V-botten. Eller så kan vi få en bottenfas där marknaden börjar konsolidera, röra sig sidledes, köpare, säljare kommer i balans. Så att vi bryter upp oss från den här bottenfasen. Och jag ser väl inte tecken idag att vi har varken en B-botten eller att marknaden har börjat konsolidera. Så att det, jag tror att vi kommer fortsätta se de här lite återhämtningarna som vi fick här nu senaste veckan. Lite återhämtning och så blir investerare lite mer positiva för att aktiemarknaden har stigit lite grann och sen säger off och sen marknaden går ner. Så nu gjorde det här igår 4% i USA. Raderar flera dagars uppgång och så hoppar man mellan hopp och förtvivlan. Kastas fram och tillbaka. Så att det är en svår period vi är inne.
Ja.
Helt klart. Jag såg att de kommer justera lite momentum ETF-er. Du som kollar på momentum, jag vet att du också kollar på det här.
Ja, exakt. Jag följer ju inte en momentum ETF per se, därför att det traditionella sättet att se på det, eller vetenskapliga sättet att se på momentum, är att du köper en aktie som noterar 52 veckors högsta och så tar man bort en månad och så skalar man ut sånt som då tappar i momentum då. Och den här rebalanseringen görs lite olika beroende på vad det är för ETF, men det är några stora som kommer att rulla här nu vid halvårsskiftet då.
iShares.
Precis, iShares är ju en av giganterna där då. Och jag såg någon uppskattning här som gjordes att 75% av innehaven kommer att rebalanseras. Det betyder inte att alla kommer åka ut, men man tror ju till exempel att det kommer komma in mycket energiaktier. Ska vi se vad det är mer då? Ut med teknologi, eller på bekostnad av teknologi, en del kanske är kvar.
In med value, va? Förutom energi då?
Ja, precis. Till exempel hälsovård tror man kommer komma in mer utav, och banker kommer då lämna i större utsträckning eller skalas ner då. Och det är väl så det har sett ut här. Det har ju varit de sektorer som det har varit lite momentum, de rent offensiva och energi på grund av rådande omständigheter. Där.
Exakt. Jag har ju en modell på momentum som ofta visar i mina YouTube-filmer. NQ, momentum, rank, volatilitetsjusterat momentum. Och den är ju betydligt mycket snabbare än de beräkningar som de här momentum ETF:erna kör. Och det är ju en anledning till det, att hela tiden försöka fronta de här och ligga lite före. För där har till exempel energi och högutdelare, value, telekom, healthcare och så vidare. De har ju rankats högt på mitt momentum relativt länge då. Men sen också en anledning till att en trend ofta, den pågår ofta lite längre än vad man tror. Ofta när jag tänker så här, men nu ska det nog vända, så brukar jag försöka påminna mig själv om att ja, men då kanske pågår lite längre. Och det får man också bekräftas på nu när de här giganterna går in och köper och rebalanserar momentum. Det är rätt sent. De behöver få bekräftelse på den här starka trenden. Mm. Det är så de här ETF-erna fungerar. Det kan inte vara för kortsiktiga. Men det förstärker rörelser.
Mm. Absolut.
Det går lite längre på uppsidan och det går lite längre på den sidan.
Mm.
Hela tiden.
Helt rätt. Och på tal om förändringar då, så är det ju även MSCI, de gör ju indexförändringar och det kommer man göra då slutet av maj här. Och MSCI Global Standard, där kommer då att inkluderas Holmen, Indutrade, Sobi och Volvo Cars.
Mm.
Inga svenska, andra svenska aktier kommer att lämna just det indexet som är lite större. Och det brukar ju vara så att säga lite stödjande att de stora förvaltarna och indexförvaltarna framförallt då som följer de här indexen, de kommer då köpa upp så att de ligger så att säga marknadsneutrala i de här indexen. Och just de här nämnda aktierna ser ju lite intressanta ut, men av olika anledningar. Det är stora formationer och sådär. Jag har ingen aning om man ska köpa dem idag eller inte här. Jag har noterat att Volvo Cars, som jag bland annat äger i Alcott Equities, har ju fått in en del köprekommendationer här sista tiden då. Men om man tittar på dem i ett lite större perspektiv så ser de ju tekniskt sett intressanta. Tittar vi på MSCI Global Small Cap så kommer då bolag som AddLife, Carry Group, Note, Storskogen, Synsam, Truecaller och Xano ta plats.
Storskogen sa du?
Ja.
Det var innan,
innan skogen brann.
Exakt. Och Tesla åker ur ESG-index där, noterar jag.
Exakt.
Elon Musk var inte jätteglad.
Nej, han tycker ju att det är lite fuffel och båg där med ESG och det är ju det att...
Vad tycker du, Jonas?
Nej, men jag tycker inte att det är båg. Däremot så är det en evolverande
process.
Process. Och det här har vi haft gäster som har pratat om och varit experter på i podden. Börja med exkluderingskriterierna från kyrkans tid och Sverige var väldigt tidiga med det här. Och Sverige har ju mycket satt den här standarden, men den är inte färdigarbetad. Hur ska man göra med försvarsaktier? Ska man ha dem eller inte? Ett bolag som ska avveckla sin oljeverksamhet, kan man investera i det? Ska man köpa ett SSAB som förbrukar jättemycket energi men som har slutmål att ha en fantastisk produkt som är koldioxidneutral? Det finns massor av sådana överväganden som inte är lätta att ta.
Ja.
Och det är klart att
arbetsförhållanden och så vidare.
Ja, precis. Det är ju fler bokstäver som ska...
Inte bara miljö.
Nej, exakt.
Det är komplext.
Komplext är det.
Får återkomma till det, eventuellt.
Men vad tycker du om att bjuda in vår spännande gäst då? Andrea Ciccione från Lombard.
Det gör vi.
Very welcome back to the pod, Andrea. Very nice to have you here. Could you please tell our listeners a little bit about yourself and about Lombard?
Right. So I've been working at TS Lombard for about 10 years now. So I'm pretty well settled in. It's a great place. Among the brightest minds in economics. Those I've met working for investment banks and so on. My background has been in engineering to begin with. I've actually worked in Sweden for 2 years in 2000 2001, so it's always a pleasure to be back here. Sweden has a special place in my heart. But yeah, I moved to finance about 15 years ago and been doing that ever since. It's very exciting to be covering financial markets. Definitely something I enjoy.
And you're working with a top-down analysis, macro. Can you describe the process?
Sure. I started off as a credit strategist, so mostly working at things from a top-down perspective, but in credit markets. Over the years, I've been widening up my expertise to the broader fixed income market, and then more recently, equities. And now I look at things mostly from a multi-asset point of view. TS Lombard was founded about 35 years ago as a macro house, so our process is very much top-down. We do try and meet top-down with bottom-up analysis when applicable, but for the most part, we try and build a complete picture of the world, how the interconnectedness of different countries through flow of funds, sectoral balances, and how these inform asset class performance over time.
Right. I've had the pleasure to look at your analysis for a while, but could you describe for our professional listeners what kind of services you have?
Right, so we've got three main services. One is a macro service where our economists provide a coverage of the global economy. We also offer an investment strategy service where we basically draw conclusions from the macro view. We answer the so what question. So our view of the world, what does that mean for investors, what they should be doing about it? And then we have an emerging market service where we cover from the bottom up a number of important emerging market countries, often having boots on the ground with analysts based in those countries like Brazil, India, and so on.
Right. And if we look at the current sell-off on the global stock markets, do you think it's just a correction or is it a bigger bear market we're in?
We think it's a bigger bear market. Bear markets tend to last a relatively long period of time. The one we had in 2020 was exceptionally unusual. It lasts only 1 month. Normally, proper bear markets last for longer. We don't see anything structurally wrong with the economy going forward, so this might not be one of the longest bear markets we experience. But definitely, there's a resetting of expectations going on right now. And the world is going through a phase which would have been difficult in any cycle because the cycle is transitioning from the expansion stage, which is very fast growth, very easy gains made, to the steady state. So that transition is always critical. And you can see that in equity performance, typically, that there's a bit of a hiatus at this stage of the cycle. But this particular cycle is being made even more difficult, the transition, by, of course, the war in Ukraine, the slowdown of China, and the fact that inflation is being driven not so much by demand as it's been the case over the past 40 years, but by a big spike in commodity prices and supply chain disruptions, which are making it really hard for central banks to decide what to do.
Mm-hmm. Then if you anticipate a bear market, what are you telling your clients now about risky assets? You have some kind of model portfolio, I guess?
Sure. So we've been de-risking our model portfolio quite steadily since the start of the year. We've always thought that 2022 was going to be more tricky than 2021 has been because of, as I said, the steady state that the cycle is transitioning towards. Then, of course, the war in Ukraine made things a lot worse, and the slowdown in China with the Evergrande problems and everything that relates to the property sector. What we're telling investors is it's a very difficult market, this one, because one, inflation is counter-cyclical, which means both stocks and bonds are selling off at the same time. And that's because of the nature of inflation, but also because the Fed is going to do QT, and generally central banks around the world are going to shrink their balance sheet, or they're going to try to. And this is the opposite of QE. So when you have QE going on, typically all asset classes rally at the same time. So when you have QT, typically the opposite happens. So there are two reasons for stocks and bonds to sell off at the same time. So it's a very tricky environment for that reason. But we think that right now stocks are the asset class that's going to be more challenged, at least in the near term.
Where do you shelter? Is it inflation-linked bonds or commodity-intense countries? I think of Canada, Australia, perhaps, value stocks, Switzerland.
That's right. So shelter? Definitely, if you're an equity investor, so you haven't got the luxury to rotate in other asset classes, definitely, I would say, commodity-focused countries are a good place to hide. So you mentioned them, Australia to a degree, but now Australia is very exposed to China, so maybe it's not the best of times for Australia, but Canada is a better choice. In emerging markets, Brazil, South Africa, are not bad options, but all on a relative basis. I think when the stock market is under severe pressures as it is now, everything tends to perform negatively. So you can find some relative performance in these markets, as you can in value and defensives. But I don't think investors should expect positive returns from either these countries or these sectors.
Right. And you mentioned that you have, during the year, becoming more and more defensive. What kind of factors did you see before to get more defensive in the first place?
No, it's a very good point. We saw that activity was slowing down. This is especially coming through from surveys like ISM manufacturing survey, the PMI numbers. They've been literally falling off a cliff in China, but even in the US, which has been
still very high levels, but they're turning over.
They're turning lower. But at the same time, and that's the unusual part, you've seen first prices paid by companies going up, which normally isn't the case when activity slows. Normally prices paid and activity tend to move in sync, which means margins are going to come under pressure. Slower growth, higher costs, inability by companies to pass on higher costs to customers means margins are coming under pressure. So that's not a very good environment for stocks. And, you know, margins were very high to begin with. So it's not like margins are contracting to a level where they're really dangerous. But nevertheless, expectations on the side of investors need to readjust to a lower normal. And that process is being accelerated by central banks around the world sounding as hawkish as I've ever heard them to be.
You mentioned also that you've been working with the credit markets. For example, if you're looking at high yield versus investment grade, those spreads, they are still increasing. What does that tell you?
Well, I mean, there's nothing fundamentally wrong with the credit market right now. If you look at fundamental drivers, whether it's growth, whether it's earnings, as I said, earnings are, you know, margins are under pressure, but earnings are still growing at the moment. And credit quality is actually going up. Now, credit quality as expressed by rating agencies, which are not exactly leading indicators, they normally lag what really goes on in the credit market. But nevertheless, there's nothing fundamentally wrong. What's really hurting for credits at the moment is two things: financial conditions, which are getting tighter, and risk appetite. So both of these things have a very strong bearing on credit market performance, and both of them have been weakening quite substantially since the start of the year. So in this phase, we got a model for the credit cycle. We think that investors are better served by selling the rallies or fading the rallies than by buying the dip. That applies to stocks, but also to the credit market.
Where do you stand in respect to competitors? In your views, do you think you stand out? What's your perception?
Well, I was reading an analysis of the Bank of America Merrill Lynch Asset Managers survey made by Bank of America themselves. They were trying to gauge from the responses they get from asset managers whether maybe a bottom for the equity market had already been reached. And their conclusion was that it wasn't. The point, though, is that the responses that asset managers have given to Bank of America Merrill Lynch in their survey is that they still have relatively low balances of cash. They're still relatively overweight equities or long equities. In other words, they haven't quite fully de-risked yet. And I think we are ahead of them. So we are already short risk versus our benchmark. We've been for 2 months now. So we started de-risking at the start of the year, but we've only got net short risk a month ago. And we have a very high cash balance. We are underweight equities. And we've even started increasing our allocation to government bonds, which is still, in our view, the right thing to do in a recessionary environment. And that hasn't happened at the asset manager level. So maybe our competitors are catching up with our view, but definitely we don't think that the market has fully realized the scope of what's going on with the global economy.
Right. I actually watched a market video on YouTube. It was with you for a couple of years ago. You were mentioning in four different cycles, and I saw a breath chart. Mm-hmm. Different how many number of countries in different cycles. Can you explain how that model works and how it look today?
Sure. Well, we look at the cycle a lot. So I mentioned the credit cycle earlier. From a credit cycle point of view, we look at different indicators from macro to financial conditions, to risk appetite, to leverage. We think that these are the four main ingredients in a credit cycle. And as I said before, macro is still looking relatively okay, but our forecast is that macro is going to decelerate going into the second half of the year, whereas all the other indicators are turning lower. Some of them have been turning lower for some time and quite sharply indeed. The good thing about looking at things from a cyclical point of view is that the cycle has some momentum in it. So even though these indicators might not necessarily be forward-looking or leading indicators, they tell you where you are, in this case, in the credit cycle, and very likely where you're going to be over the next 3 to 6 months. Our credit cycle indicator is definitely pointing towards a prolonged slowdown stage. And we define that as growth being below potential and decelerating. So that's at the global level. If you look at individual countries, they all are at different stages of their own respective cycles, but you can gauge the breadth of the slowdown by looking at how many of them are already in the downturn or slowdown phase of the cycle. We are at a crossover point where the majority of countries are still in the downturn stage. Downturn being growth above potential but decelerating. But there are nearly as many countries already in slowdown, which is below potential and still decelerating. So this, in our view, signifies more momentum towards slowdown as more and more countries graduate, so to speak, from the downturn, which is the early stages of a negative swing in the cycle, to the slowdown, which is the proper weakest part of the economic cycle.
Yeah. And the stock market, when it bottoms, it will be much earlier than the economic cycle. You mentioned before that you're looking at the risk appetite, for example. How do you measure risk appetite, and what kind of indicators do you look at to view the stock market's sentiment?
Right, so we look at a number of indicators, so we try not to rely on a single time series or number. But we look at things such as the VIX, for example, which gives you a feeling of risk appetite in equity markets. The MOVE index, which is a volatility index for bonds. But also investor surveys such as the State Street Investor Sentiment Survey. There's the AAII Retail Investor Sentiment Survey. That's more of a shorter term thing. So we look at a number of factors, and that gives us an indication of how investors are positioned and how they perceive risk to be. I think it's quite interesting that if you look at volatility, we've done an analysis a few years ago, which we keep going back to quite regularly, that shows that when volatility is quite elevated and not just because of a temporary spike, but because of being kind of structurally higher, so to speak, well, that's typically a weak part of the market cycle. And as we know all too well, the VIX has been very high for quite a few months now. And that to us indicates that there's something fundamentally wrong with the stock market that's going to keep it under pressure for some time.
There will be some sort of inflection point from a central bank point of view, and the inflation is probably in the future. But do you think that the central banks are able to soft land the economies, or is it inevitable?
Nothing.
No, I mean, it's possible. It's been done before, not very often, though. So for the most part, central banks are not able to engineer a soft landing. More often than not, they ended up causing a crash landing or a hard landing, maybe. But, you know, as recently as 2019, a hiking cycle by the Fed didn't end up in a recession. There was the stated objective was achieved. Eventually, there was massive stress building up in funding markets, particularly in the repo market, which led the American Central Bank to say, well, okay, we're done with the hiking cycle. They still kept shrinking the balance sheet for a few more months, but the market stabilized, but not before selling off by more than, well, by 20% there or thereabout. So what are central banks going to do this time? I think they're facing a very different problem this time. They've kept monetary policy way too loose for way too long. They're massively behind. The US economy especially is booming. There's a tightness in the labor market like I've never seen before, certainly not throughout my career. And that's creating a very high pace of wage growth. And this has been going for long enough that the risk is that these expectations of higher wages stemming from higher inflation becoming entrenched in consumer and labor behavior. That's the kind of stuff that can create an inflation process, as we call it. So inflation is not just the change in prices. So if commodity prices, say oil price, goes from 60 to 100 as a one-off, that's not inflation. That's a price change over time that sort of normalizes. What an inflation process is, either a wage inflation feedback loop, so more inflation causes more wage growth and vice versa, or as our US chief economist likes to say, inflation needs to be financed. And by that he means that people need to bring forward their spending because they believe that the wages are going to go up in the future. So they borrow against these expected future earnings and they spend these future earnings today. So for that, of course, you need to have credit growth. And we're starting to see the signs of that. So far, there hasn't been any major sign of credit growth and therefore no threat of an inflation process in the making. But now we're starting to see that. And that's why central banks have become so aggressive and are sounding as hawkish as they have in 2022.
Do you think it's peak hawkish now, or will they maybe even become more hawkish here in 2022?
We've been surprised before by how hawkish they were going to sound. We thought we had seen peak hawkishness when the market was pricing in 4 hikes this year, and then the Fed started hinting at 50 basis point hikes, and now that's the accepted norm. The unit is now 50 basis points, it's no longer 25 basis points. Can they become more hawkish? We don't think so in the near term, but you never know. The risk is that we get more inflation shocks, and that might come from different sources. Either this inflation process taking hold and credit growth sharply accelerating, that would be good inflation because it's driven by demand. But even worse would be a counter-cyclical inflation shock coming from more supply chain disruptions, maybe because China keeps locking down the economy every now and again, or even worse, from another spike in energy prices because maybe Russia weaponizes gas prices, oil prices, or maybe even wheat prices or fertilizer prices. So far, the West has been fighting a war against Russia mostly through the financial channel by sanctions and restricting the ability of the Russian central bank to do business effectively. And Putin, which is not winning the war at the moment, might decide to retaliate using the same currency through the financial channel by creating another spike in gas prices. So if we get that, we get another wave of inflation, the bad kind of inflation, not driven by demand, but because of supply-side reasons, over which central banks have got little ability to fight back. But they still have to because that's their mandate. So that would be a bad outcome for the global economy. It's not a central case. Mm. It's a risk case scenario, but something that we need to think about.
And as rates are going up globally, where's the biggest risk in Europe, for example?
Right, so that's a very good question. clearly you probably have to be concerned about the countries with the most risk. So my home country, Italy, is of course the one that stands out the most. Spain has been, obviously a problem in the past. I think something has fundamentally changed after Draghi's, promised to do whatever it takes to save the euro. The central bank, the ECB, has become more of a euro area central bank and less of the Bundesbank, if you want. And I think there's appreciation across the euro area that a central bank needs to stand by the member states and make sure that the transmission of monetary policy is functioning properly. There are tools in place. The PEP, the Pandemic Emergency Purchase Program, has been very successful in doing that. OMT is still there potentially to be used. So that should keep a lid on peripheral spreads. But the reality is that in the near term, peripheral spreads are effectively part of the credit market, and they get driven by the same fundamentals as credit markets. And as we've said at the beginning of this podcast, the fundamentals for credit are not that bad, but there are other things driving spreads wider. So we expect peripheral spreads to continue to widen in the near term, but eventually either the problem sorts out by itself or the central bank will intervene to make sure that they remain contained, again, to ensure that the transmission of monetary policy is achieved. And if spreads are out of control, effectively the ECB cannot set monetary policy for peripheral countries. So that's become unacceptable. So I think we've got a stronger ECB now compared to 2010, 2011 at the time of the euro crisis.
If we return to China in the five quick ones, I sensed you were not too positive. The Chinese government has said 5.5 is where we're heading, and they're clearly below trend now due to the shutdowns. Do you think they can catch up and that could alter a boost from a global standpoint, since they are big part of the puzzle now in global trade?
Jonas is very bullish to China.
I'm very interested right.
Funnily enough, we are tactically bullish on Chinese equities right now, and we can,
there you go, Jonas.
we can talk through as to why we are. But on the economy, China will probably hit that 5.5% target because the numbers are whatever they want them to be.
I know.
And that's why we calculate our own GDP figures. They're all based on official statistics provided by China. But we start with nominal GDP and then we deflate it using a set of proprietary deflators, also based on official data. Now, the benefits of using this approach is that although you're still using official data, so you're not quite sure whether it's completely reliable or not, at least our measure of GDP shows the cycle within the Chinese economy, something that the official numbers just absolutely don't show. It's a straight line, what you get provided by China itself. And right now, our numbers are indicating that China is running below the official statistics. Over time, our numbers tend to match the official statistics. So we just see the cycle around the official numbers. And right now we are below the cycle. We think that's going to remain the case over the next few quarters. I think the main difference compared to previous episodes when China was slowing down, mostly for exogenous reasons, i.e. during the global financial crisis, for instance, is that it's kind of exhausted its balance sheet capacity as an economy. So the standard way China used to get itself out of trouble was to stimulate credit growth and invest. And we think that now they've been leveraging different sectors of the economy and they're kind of running out of balance sheets to leverage up. So we think that although they're going to stimulate the economy, they will provide some stimulus, they're easy monetary policy, the scope and scale of this stimulus will be nothing like previous episodes. And therefore, the ripple effect for the global economy is going to be relatively minimal.
But you're still tactically bullish on China, but you're bearish on the economic side. Can you tell us what factors are behind the bullish tactical view on China?
Right, so we are worried about the global cycle, but the cycle in China is more advanced. Of course, they've been creating a lot of damage, especially for tech stocks, which are a big chunk of the Chinese MSCI index, which is the one we track in our market calls, by pursuing this global prosperity, this carbon prosperity policy, and cracking down on out of control tech from Xi Jinping's point of view. So a lot of damage has already been caused. Valuations are very cheap for Chinese tech, unlike tech in other parts of the world, namely the United States, first and foremost. And more recently, that push on the common prosperity mantra has been de-emphasized by China. Xi Jinping is a very dogmatic leader. He will probably be appointed for a third term at the Communist Party Congress at the end of the year. But we're already starting to see Prime Minister Li Keqiang starting to gain more prominence. Maybe people are within the Chinese establishment not so happy about this very dogmatic approach by Xi Jinping to a point that's hurting the economy. And maybe someone more pragmatic and less dogmatic, someone like Li Keqiang, more focused on the economy, is a good counterpoint to the dogmatism of Xi Jinping. So because of this, because the cycle is more advanced, because valuations have gone a long way, because of maybe more pragmatism going forward, we think from a purely tactical point of view, it's not such a bad time to be relatively optimistic on Chinese stocks.
And is that as well for like the U.S. stock market? Given the valuations are much lower today, the sentiment is very low. If we see like a bounce or a longer bear market rally, is that something that you're having like a house view?
Yes, I mean we've been talking about a possible bounce in stocks. If you look at sentiment indicators, they were, I mentioned earlier, the AAII Investor Sentiment Survey. As I said, it's a very short-term signal you get, and it's a contrarian signal. So when sentiment is very bearish, normally that's a time to buy. And as recently as 2 weeks ago, that indicator was as low as it's been in March 2009. And I'm sure you all remember what happened in March 2009. The bear market from the global financial crisis ended, and one of the longest rallies in history began. A short-term rebound is definitely on the cards. If you look at market behavior yesterday, you might think, well, maybe not. But we think that the fundamentals are more important at this stage, not so much valuations. What we said to our clients this month in our asset allocation report is, forget valuations. There are red herring at this stage. What's going to drive market performance is the earnings trajectory. And as that gets derated from very high expectation to something a lot more subdued, that's going to be what drives equity performance, not valuations. Now, mind you, the US is not cheap yet, has cheapened, but it's not cheap. Especially tech is still on the expensive side. We talked about a tech bubble as early as July 2020. Too early, obviously, but in November when the vaccines came out, we said, well, valuations are still a problem, but forget valuations. They don't matter right now. What matters is that there's going to be a massive recovery, and that's going to favor the stock market. Right now, we are going through a slowdown stage. We're going down a period where central banks will tighten monetary policy, financial conditions are tightening. QT is going to be a significant drag on valuations, on stock market performance. And the more important thing is not valuations, is the earnings trajectory, and the economy is slowing. So that's why we advise clients to still be careful on stocks.
Right.
With the interest rates going up, how do you perceive real estate investments?
Oh, well, that's a fantastic question, and one I had myself, because I talk to clients and quite a few of them tell me, well, I mean, we have an inflation problem, so real estate being a real asset, as the name suggests, must be a great place to be. And my initial reaction is just, I'm not sure. Real estate it's not like fixed income, but it's closer to fixed income than other sectors of the stock market. Even physical real estate is closer to fixed income than a lot of things, especially commercial real estate. Leases are set for 5 to 10 years sometimes. So it's very close to a relatively long duration fixed income instrument. And we are in an environment where central banks are screaming off the rooftops that they're going to tighten monetary policy and increase interest rates. How can that be a good environment for real estate, which relies so much on funding and cheap funding at that? So I asked that question to our real estate specialist. We've got an in-house Asia real estate specialist. And I told him, look, is real estate good when inflation is high because it's a real asset? Or are funding costs increasing and therefore that's bad for real estate? And I got a very standard answer from him, which is, it depends, which wasn't great, wasn't exactly what I was looking for. But basically he said, when inflation is relatively moderate, say 3 to up to 6% at a stretch, real estate is a good hedge against inflation. But when inflation is more than moderate, it's quite high, 6% and beyond, then the sort of higher cost of funding weighs on the real estate sector. And that's unfortunately where we are right now. So unless we get a resolution in the inflation issue that we have in fairly soon, I'm afraid real estate is probably not where you want to be right now.
On that theme then, the problem with the inflation can be solved if we don't buy stuff. Do you think that this will accelerate people's, you know, fear for their money and taking more care and saving more going forward, and that will, you know, eventually break the inflation with also the help from the central banks? Will that process be much, much quicker? Will we be over this during this year even?
That's what central banks are hoping. They are used to inflation being what it's been in the past 40 years, which is pro-cyclical inflation, which is demand-driven inflation. Mm-hmm. Central banks, by setting interest rates, i.e. the cost of money, or more recently, the quantity of money through QE, they control demand. They got a good, powerful lever to influence demand. But unfortunately, the inflation we got right now is counter-cyclical. It's not caused by demand. It's caused by supply-side factors like supply chain disruptions or commodity prices. Nevertheless, central banks, the only lever they've got is the cost of money or the quantity of money. And they will try and use the only tool they've got to try and bring inflation down. It might not be as effective as it's been in the past 40 years because inflation is different. But nevertheless, eventually, they are prepared to engineer even a recession, if need be, to make sure that that demand deflation that higher rates generate eventually causes inflation to come down. And it's a compromise, especially for the Fed, who have a dual mandate, not just inflation, but also employment. You got full employment now, and they don't want unemployment to go up, but they need to create slack in the job market. For other central banks, it's easier. Their only target is inflation, and that's what they're going to do, get inflation down. And that means tight monetary policy, not just tighter, but properly tight monetary policy. Yeah.
And if that happens, we are in a market environment where the inflation decelerates. At the same time, growth will decelerate. What kind of market environment is that?
Well, I think the main reason, especially the stock market, but also the bond market, have been performing so poorly this year is because of the shock of the hawkishness by central banks. So it's a bit like the tapered tantrum we had in 2014. But this time it's been not a tapered tantrum, it's been a rates tantrum. And it's affecting both bonds, but also stocks, which were relatively unaffected in 2014 because they were so cheap at the time. Now they weren't cheap, they were expensive. So both have sold off. Now, the moment we get in a more comfortable place with rates, you know, in the central bank size, I think this market can find some relief, some heart. It's been the change in expectations that has been driving valuations down so much and bond yields up so much. If those expectations sort of level off from here, maybe because growth slows, maybe because inflation rolls over, as you suggested, well, then maybe this market, there's nothing fundamentally wrong with it, this market can start recovering somewhat.
That sounds great.
Shall we take some final questions?
Yeah.
It's been a lot of market turmoil. How do you relax from all of this? What do you do?
Oh, yeah. Relaxing. I like to travel, like most people out there. So holidays is very much what I'm looking forward to. Mm-hmm. The summer is still a couple of months away, but that's what I've set my sight on. Mm-hmm. So I really look forward to traveling a little bit this summer.
Right. We have both professional and private investors listening to this podcast. How can private investors follow your thoughts and your research? Do you have any social media channels or YouTube or something, a blog on the website?
I do put a few thoughts, a few charts, especially out there on Twitter, so people can follow me on Twitter. Mm. The handle is Andrea_Ciccione, so name underscore surname. Some of my colleagues are very active on Twitter, especially Dario Perkins. So you can find out what we think, but just following us on Twitter, absolutely. Of course, our clients get a better service than that, but I think you'll get the broad brush thinking of TS Lombard by following the key people on Twitter.
And I must say that I had the opportunity to look at the research, and from a professional point of view, I think anyone listening to this and want to reach out and go into the website and look for contact details there would be a good opportunity.
Right.
Andrea, thank you very much for coming.
Thanks very much for having me.
Thank you. Ja, sammanfattar veckans avsnitt. Vad vill du lyfta fram?
Rekylen förmodligen inte är över. Eller rekylen, det kommer sannolikt att fortsätta vara ett svagt klimat. Och dina indikatorer pekar ju dithän också. Att vi inte har fått den där bottenkänningen, även om det kan ralla på någon dag och så. Fortfarande väldigt osäkert så att säga, klimat då. Men under ytan så är det mycket som händer. Index som rebalanseras och så. Sen gästen tycker jag var fantastiskt intressant då. André som ju hade väldigt mycket synpunkter som varande chefstrateg på Lombard, som ju är ett analyshus. Man kan som professionell investerare köpa analys ifrån då. Och jag prova på och tittat på det där under någon månad och tycker att de gör ett fantastiskt jobb. De är lite free thinkers då. Det finns några handfull namn som är riktigt bra och de här tillhör dem tycker jag. Då. Vad tog du med dig av?
Jag har ju antecknat jättemycket här. Jag tror jag aldrig antecknat så mycket under ett samtal här.
Nej.
Jag kan ta några saker. Han trodde på en längre bear market, var reset of expectations. Slowdown i Kina ekonomiskt, men var lite taktiskt bullish till Kina. Det konsensus, det tycker jag var lite intressant. Han menar på att konsensus är fortsatt inte jättenegativa nu om man kollar på professionella fondförvaltare och så vidare. Han hänvisar lite grann till fondförvaltare-enkäterna från Bank of America Merrill Lynch. Menar på att de har dragit ner risk och så vidare, men menar på att överlag den stora flocken inte riktigt är så defensiv eller negativ som de kanske kommer att det bli då. Vilket då också var ett argument för att det kanske finns mer nedsida på marknaden då. De kollar lite grann på VIX, han kollar på MOVE-index, han kollar på AI sentimentsenkäten som vi brukar prata om, Bank of America Merrill Lynch-enkäten som vi brukar prata om. Han pratar lite grann om VIX, när den är på hög nivå, stalker den som bearish, när den biter sig fast på höga nivåer. Annars brukar man, vissa brukar mena på om den kommer upp på hög nivå så brukar det sammanfalla med botten på aktiemarknaden. Men det är väldigt svårt att veta när den där botten kommer.
Mm.
Jag tror att det är bättre att se VIXen som att okej, okay, den är på hög nivå. All right, då ska man vara lite mer försiktig för att volatilitet är mycket högre. Han trodde kanske inte att Fed skulle bli mer hawkish. Det var lite peak Hawkiners som han såg det på. Kolla på cykeln i Kina. De har lite andra siffror där. Kunde se de här kortare cyklarna.
Intressant.
Fundamentals är viktigare än värderingar. Han sa glöm värderingar. Det är USA. Det är inte ens billigt nu.
Kan bli billigare men inte billigt.
Ja, billigare men inte billigt. Pratade lite grann om fastighetsaktier eller bolag på din fråga där. Vad tyckte han om det som inflationsskydd?
Han tyckte väl kanske inte att Netnet var speciellt investeringsbart på de här nivåerna. Upp till en 6% inflation tyckte han att då är det okej. För att det är som en någon typ av obligationstillgång, men kommer man upp över det, då kommer ju finansieringskostnaden för fastigheter som ju bygger mycket av underliggande värdet över sikt, eller på sikt, och affärerna inte minst, kommer ju då att minska. Och därför var det inte speciellt intressant på de här nivåerna, tyckte han.
Just det. Var det någonting annat där som du vill plocka fram?
Jag menar ju också på att det är en kontracyklisk inflation som då styrs av utbudsstörningar och inte av efterfråga. Är det styrt av efterfråga, då är det en bra inflation. Mm. Och nu tyckte han det var en dålig inflation.
Dålig inflation. Jobbet för centralbankerna. Och man kan ju då följa både Andrea och hans kollega Darry där på Twitter. Jag kan lägga till länkar i poddbeskrivningen till deras Twitterkonto, så kan man gå in och följa dem, tycker jag.
Tycker jag är helt rätt. Men jag tycker vi avrundar dagens podcast och påminner om att eventuella bolag och namn inte är några rekar, utan det är observationer. Ta hand om er och ha en riktigt trevlig helg.
Trevlig helg.